Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Our presenter this afternoon is Richard Lyon, who's the head of the Individual Risk Actuarial Function at TAL. Been there since October, Richard. So you know how to run the place by now. Good. Prior to that, he had quite an extensive career. I think it's best described as consulting, with a little diversion into a startup, an indemnity underwriting agency. Perhaps we should talk about that instead. No?
I get a bigger audience.
Okay, fine. Rich is going to talk to us about intergenerational issues. A couple of housekeeping issues, though, please. If you want to ask a question, would you please do so at the mic? And would you identify yourself and where you're from? And I've been told that for those of you who know how to use the app, that is, you're under 25, would you please put your comments on the session in the app? Thank you. Richard?
Thank you.
Thank you, John. I'm going to hope I can work this button, otherwise I'll keep leaning down there. Okay, seems to work. My presentation is in four unequal sections, and you'll be very pleased they're unequal by the time we get to the end of section three. So first, I'm going to say something about the intergenerational report, because that's what put me onto this topic. I was on an institute task force to comment on the 2015 IGR, and last year I co-wrote a paper for the 2016 Financial Services Forum. And you might get a hint of my attitude to that IGR by the title of that paper, which was Lies, Damned Lies and the 2015 IGR. Then, as promised in the synopsis for the session, I try to be true to label, I looked at the income aspects of IGE, which is intergenerational equity, by discussing cohort incomes. And in that, I was using the Luxembourg income study data, which was supporting analysis that was published by The Guardian in March last year. And here I should say that my research has very much been opportunistic. I've just scavenged, found some data, and used it. So I imagine there's plenty of people with much better data, much more relevant, who can tell me that, you know, all my conclusions are completely wrong. But I'm the one standing up here, so we'll go with mine for the moment. Thirdly, I look at house prices as a proxy for the wealth aspect of intergenerational equity. And I'm going to do all that before actually suggesting a definition of intergenerational equity. So in my final section, I'll attempt to cover that and the real issues of intergenerational equity. And the next few slides are derived from the presentation of last year's paper. So the IGR is governed by legislation, namely the Charter of Budget Honesty Act 1998, which says in section 21, for those who care, an intergenerational report is to assess the long-term sustainability of current government policies over the 40 years following the release of the report, including by taking account of the financial implications of demographic change. So put simply, the IGR is intended to ensure that the government has regard to the impact of today's decisions on future generations with a clear focus on sustainability. Chapter 6 of the 2010 IGR is all about sustainability. It's on the subject of a sustainable society. The 2015 IGR, however, focuses almost entirely on financial measures, effectively defining sustainability as a fiscal surplus. This has relatively little to do with equity. And this is the US. If growing economic prosperity were the key objective, then the USA would, I think, be a pretty good example of success, economic prosperity. But look at all the federal budget surpluses that the USA has enjoyed since 1930. Have a careful look, they're the little ones above the line. Mind you, other than for the lead-up to the GFC, Australia's chart would have looked pretty similar. But despite our views about the appropriateness of the IGR, we did build a model to broadly replicate the 2015 IGR, and we used it to examine some fiscal sensitivities. And this slide really is just to demonstrate how clever we were in doing that. And we used our model to estimate the impact of different strategies in relation to the age pension. I don't expect you to pick up all the stuff on there. I just want you to be impressed. So we saw what would happen if you adjusted the eligibility age, if you adjusted the indexation rate, and also what happened if older age participation rates changed in response. And those who were in Stuart Rogers' session this morning would have heard him talk about participation rates and the relevance of them. Our 2016 presentation also canvassed the question of cohort analysis of intergenerational equity, and we showed a slide like this one. And this is from a Guardian analysis of Luxembourg income study data. You've all heard of the Luxembourg income study, I'm sure. Probably read it as often as you can get hold of it. The Guardian was trying to demonstrate an intergenerational transfer from the young to the old by showing the change in each cohort's relative income compared with the national average. Now, it's important for the next few graphs that you get that. This is relative income compared to the national average. So if you're bang on the national average, you're going to be in the middle of the graph. If you're below the national average, you'll be below. If you're above, you'll be above. Eight countries were studied, namely Australia, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, the UK, and the USA. These charts from The Guardian are for Australia, and that brings me to the second part of my presentation. So it's possible to read the key data from The Guardian article, it's online, and use it to perform some rudimentary analysis. The key measure, the measure, is disposable household income. So this is after taxes and welfare transfers. It's for households, not individuals. And it's divided, in this case, into five-year cohorts by the age of the head of the household. So that means if the head of the household is 50 to 54, then it doesn't matter how many 30-year-olds, 20-year-olds, whatever, are in the household. They will not show up in their own age cohort. They'll only show up in that 50 to 54 cohort. It's not at all clear how comparable this data is between countries, between periods, or between households, other than it's all stored and collected and stored in the one place in this Luxembourg income study. So there must be some common approach to it all. But hey, it's available data. It looks interesting. So let's do some clever analysis. So this is the same charts that we saw before, but just laid on top of each other to look really muddled and confusing. What it shows is income data for Australia, as I said, from that slide 8. Each of the 12 lines, you can count them if you want to, is a five-year age group, with the youngest being 20 to 24 and the oldest being 75 to 79. And the x-axis is the year the year that we're looking at. And like The Guardian, I've interpolated between the seven measuring points that they had. So Luxembourg income study isn't an annual thing. It's, you know, every now and then they seem to pull some data in, different countries, different times. The dotted lines are the youngest age groups, and their income is generally close to and slightly above average. The oldest of those youngest groups, 35 to 39, is the highest income amongst them. Relative incomes then increase for the mid-ages. They're the dashed lines, so they're the ones at the top. And then they fall for the oldest. That's a pretty clear picture. And it's one that I think makes sense. The young are developing skills and experience that can be monetized in their 40s and 50s, and they need to be to service the mortgage and feed, clothe, and educate the family. And then in older years, we wind down at work, draw down on our savings, and take a pension. And even though there's a taxation and welfare system that shuffles money around from within that income profile, it doesn't seem appropriate that it should do too much to disturb that picture. Interpolation gives a picture of the relative income by age at each of the measuring points. So now we've got each year that it's been measured and all the ages cheating by simply linear interpolation. Nothing fancy. I can't do all that clever stuff. It's quite a stable picture, as you can kind of see. Various dots are pretty much on top of each other, not too badly apart. And that suggests that each cohort could have similar relative expectations of an income progression. So if the cohort in 1985 looks pretty similar through all the ages to the one in 2010, then it looks as though the progression is quite stable. So I would say that looks like a reasonable picture of intergenerational equity. Those in Stuart Rogers' session may recall a similar shape of income progression on one of his slides, except that this chart shows higher values for the youngest age groups. Well, I can clean this picture up a bit and look at just 85 and 2010 and the average of all the points. And you can really see it's pretty stable. There's a little bit of a trend, but it's pretty stable. The trend that's there is perhaps a little counterintuitive because it shows the young gaining at the expense of the very old and the mid-ages. And that, I would suggest, isn't what we would naturally have thought coming into the room. This may reflect greater welfare transfers to the young, or there may be an impact from the structure of taxation, for example, increases in the tax threshold. But alternatively, it could simply represent an increasing tendency of the poorer young, including those at university, to stay at home with their parents rather than move out. And of course, if they do that, they don't show up in the data. And so you get a skew to the wealthier young. And just an indication of how you should take everything that I say today with a huge pinch of salt. Now let's look at three other countries in the data. So what I've got is Germany, the UK and the US as being kind of representative of all the other countries in the data. So in 1985, so the UK is bottom left, and in 1985 its income progression was similar to ours, with the young close to the national average and the old well below. So just compare it with the one straight above, which is Australia. The German profile, top right, was distinctly flatter in 85. Presumably, this reflects a welfare system with very significant transfers from the wealthy, the mid-ages, to the poor, including the elderly. And my limited understanding is that that's essentially what happens in Germany. The US profile peaks at around the same level as Australia and the UK, but the young start off much poorer. Perhaps this reflects a lower minimum wage, less than 60% of Australia's minimum in recent times, and relatively little by way of welfare transfers. And perhaps the old have managed to accumulate wealth to generate a tax-privileged income. So if they're not being taxed too much on that income, then there's not a transfer away from them. So what's interesting, though, is the shift. By 2010, there's been a clear shift in other countries' income progression profiles away from the Australian shape. So you look at how they've moved. The old have gained relative to their national average at the expense of the young. The movement in the German profile is relatively small, but still clearly favours the old rather than the young. There's a stark change in the UK in favour of the old. It's quite huge. In the USA, the young have clearly become relatively poorer, while the rest of the profile essentially moved to the right. And I'd be happy to discuss, hear suggestions as to the reason for that when we get to the Q&A at the end of the session. But is there actual evidence to suggest a failure of intergenerational equity? Well, let's look at the actual progression of each cohort. So this, again, lots of data points, lots of mess in this picture. Each line in this picture tracks a cohort. So starting in 85 and finishing in 2010. So if you look far left, you've got those who were 20 to 24 in 85, and you can see how they follow the pattern of going up and then coming down, and then going up a bit. And it tracks the overall profile pretty well if you follow all the lines from where they start to where they finish. But there may be an issue with the youngest from 85 because they're clearly below the curve when they get to 45 to 49 in 2010. But it could be worse. So the UK profile shows that 79, as it starts in 79, shows the 79 young broadly following the trend, while the older ages clearly trend to improvement, echoing what we saw in the static comparisons. And the question there is, can all the following age groups follow that progression to higher income at the older ages? In the US, we get a degree of underperformance from the youngest age group in 79, and most other age groups finished ahead of the curve in 2010. So from their perspective, they've improved. But for equity to exist, the youngest must be able to follow suit. Overall, I would say that there's evidence that Australia enjoys relatively good intergenerational income equity compared with the rest of the world. But even the USA doesn't look too bad if trends can be maintained. But of course, that's income. What about wealth, which might be typified by home ownership? So, is it true that the affordability of housing is an intergenerational equity issue? Certainly, as a parent, I'm acutely aware of the high prices of houses and the housing wealth locked up by my generation. I suggest, though, that there are forces that underpin house price growth that are not IGE issues. And these are AWE. If people have more income, they can afford to spend more on a mortgage and therefore can borrow more. So house prices are naturally going to go up as people have more money. Mortgage interest rates. It costs more to service a loan at 10% than at 5%. So house prices should be inversely correlated with interest rates. Well, I think you'd have walked into the room knowing those two things. But what about these two? Number of incomes deployed. A dual income couple has an advantage over a single income bidder. So if there are more dual income couples competing against the singles, the house prices will go up. That's not really an intergenerational equity issue, that's simply a social trend. And quality. If houses are bigger and better, then all other things being equal, they should cost more. Over time, the proportion of disposable income that is allocated to housing has varied, but there must be limits at both ends. For my rough analysis, I've simply assumed that the proportion is constant, albeit unstated. So I've used data and assumptions in relation to these four factors to construct an index to compare with indices of median house prices. Now, of course, various other factors also have an impact, including negative gearing and foreign investors, while the prices in a particular location would also be affected by infrastructure quality, as somebody building a railway station nearby, and population growth. So, relatively speaking, a house a certain distance from the city centre gets closer to the city centre as the population grows, relatively speaking, and therefore would get more expensive. I'm going to ignore these factors as being either relatively short-term in nature, negative gearing and foreign investors perhaps, or irrelevant to the median house price in terms of building my index to see how I go against the median house prices. So if we compare house price growth with my index, the difference will relate to either intergenerational equity issues or relatively short-term supply and demand drivers. And let's be clear. if the change in house prices over a decent period can be essentially be explained by my index, and if my index is half reasonable, then affordability hasn't changed in that period. So let's start with AWE. I found median house prices from 1970, which you can see on the screen, and this is for all the state and territory capitals. And I normalised them to 100 in 1986, and my reason for doing that was simply because that's the first year for which I have a median house price for Darwin. But it's a good year to pick because it also happens to be the year when Jenny and I bought our first home, which was a two-bedroom house in Concord in Sydney. And for comparison, I've also normalised AWE at 100 in 1986. And I think you can see that house prices broadly tracked AWE from 1970 to 1986 and then took off. They kind of took off and flattened and then took off again. So 1986 doesn't seem a bad pick as a starting point, as a turning point to indicate two different periods. The median house price is now anywhere from around twice to more than three times the multiple of AWE that it was in 1986. Whatever that multiple was, I never actually went and calculated it. And of course, we all know that. It's behind all those unaffordability graphs showing median house prices divided by average income. One thing that might not be immediately clear from the chart, although you guys might all be able to instantly do the sums, is the actual rates of growth represented. AWE and house prices both grew at an average of 11.7% per annum from 1970 to 1986. Since 1986, AWE has grown at just under 4% per annum, while median house prices have grown at between just over 6% per annum for Hobart and almost 8% per annum for Sydney. So while you wouldn't necessarily pick it from the chart, even Sydney house prices have grown a lot more slowly since 86 than up to 86. It's just that AWE has been a lot less still. So now let's add interest rates. So I found standard mortgage rates from the RBA from 1959, and I actually started here with this and AWE rather than the median house prices. And they're shown, well, they're supposed to be yellow bars. I'm colour challenged. If they're yellow, they're yellow. If they're not, they're not. I'm sorry. In the 1960s, standard rates were around current levels. And remember this for later. And it's important to note I've ignored the likelihood that better than standard rates are available now by negotiation, by shopping around, by getting discounts and so on. So I'm just comparing standard with standard. Rates increased in the 1970s and 1980s, reaching the high teens, but have generally retreated since then. And I've translated these rates into an index of the relative amount purchased by a 25-year mortgage. So, for example, if you can borrow $1 million at the 5% interest rate that applied in 1960, then you can borrow just $407,000 at 1989's 17% rate. So that is, a $1 million loan at 5% is just as affordable as a $407,000 loan at 17%. And I'll ignore any concerns that you might have borrowing at 5% that interest rates are going to go up, because believe me, when rates were 17%, we were concerned that they were going up too. This is a hugely powerful driver of affordable house prices. So you can see what it's done. If I go back to the AWE, take that black line, and it's jumped it up. So combined with AWE, the index now grows at almost 6.7% per annum from 1986. And that fully explains, as it happens, current Adelaide prices. So Adelaide price movement from 86 to today, or 2016, can be explained simply by AWE and interest rates. Now let's add a proportion of second incomes. So I'm just going to assume that household borrowing in 1959 which, as I said, was my original starting point, was effectively based entirely on one income, and that by now the equivalent of 1.4 incomes is deployed on average in pursuit of a house. Well, that's a complete guess. There are reasons why that 1.4 could be higher, but it didn't seem too bad a guess to me, because it's my guess. And the reasons why it doesn't seem too bad is we have the gender pay gap, which is relevant because we're using AWE in the index already, and the likelihood that a couple would generally not want to fully commit the second income in the same way as the first, whichever income is which, and the fact that there are still plenty of single-income families and individuals competing for housing. So that's the extent of the science around my guess, and I have no supporting statistics at all. But applying that, we now get growth of almost 7.3% per annum since 1986, and this was linear as well. I just went from 1 in 59 to 1.4 in 2016, no compounding. So 7.3% per annum since 86 explains current Brisbane prices. And finally, let's allow for quality. So I did a quick search using my favourite search engine, as they say, and I found some stats on the US housing market. I'm not going to pretend that they're particularly comparable to Australia, but they showed that the average house size doubled between 1959 and 2016, and that this represented almost triple the space per person. Now, you wouldn't pay twice as much for a house that had twice the space, but you would surely pay something more. And I would suggest that houses are better equipped than they used to be. And while double brick may be less common, so is fibro, which suggests that there may be a higher structural quality. So I'm going to suggest that people would pay 1.5 times as much for the median modern house than for one that is the equivalent of what the median house was in 1959. So if you can imagine the median 1959 house, and no, I can't either, I'm going to suggest that you'd pay 1.5 times what you would pay for that for the current median house. And if you put the quality and the incomes together, you get 2.1. That doesn't seem too bad as a combination. So with all of that together, the index growth since 86 is now almost 8% per annum, and we're getting close to Sydney and Perth prices. I don't expect you to believe me, but I essentially chose the income and quality factors before I looked at the median house price data, which is why I started in 59, then found I couldn't get house prices before 1970. So I'm quite pleased with myself. So having essentially explained the past, albeit not the large fluctuations that you can see in the median prices against my index, what can I say about the future? Well, let's look at three scenarios, all allowing for interest rates being on the way back up. In the first scenario, given the broad similarity of mortgage rates today to those 50 years ago, I've assumed that 2017 to 2039 sees a repeat of 1967 to 1989 AWE growth and interest rate movement. So that's the dotted line at the top that shows house prices continuing to grow at an average of more than 7.3% per annum between now and 2039. But general economic conditions in the late 1960s were rather different from today, so my other two scenarios are more structured. They both assume AWE at 5% per annum, and actually 2% in the year to June 2017, because it's ridiculous to assume 5% in a period we know doesn't have that, and interest rates increasing linearly over 10 years from 2017, again, no change in interest rates between 16 and 17, either to 15%, which is the black dashed line, or 10%, the grey dashed line. And then once they hit that level, they just stay the same after that. And these scenarios represent average growth of 2.6% per annum and 4.1% per annum, respectively. But the former includes a period of flat house prices while interest rates increase. And by the way, my income and quality factors continue to climb linearly over the period of the projection, reaching 1.56 and 1.7 respectively in 2039. Now, all my charts have been in absolute terms, but perhaps it would have been more meaningful to relate everything to my AWE index. So here goes. Lots of dots again. Here, the dotted line, which doesn't show up in the legend, is my index, and the solid line is the average, and then the various individual dot points are the five major capitals. In relation to AWE, median house prices were broadly flat from 1970 to 1986, as I previously suggested. You can now clearly see that. With the exception of Adelaide, AWE-adjusted prices in the five major capitals then grew strongly, although Melbourne soon fell back for a while. My index, as I said, that's the dotted line, doesn't explain individual cities or individual years particularly well. But that's not too surprising, because there are plenty of short-term factors that would affect prices, and the index is crude anyway. One such short-term factor, which you can clearly see, is the recent mining boom's impact on Perth housing prices. Now, what happens if I adjust my projections for AWE? Now we get a very interesting picture. Although my index projects that house prices will grow over the period to 2039 under all three scenarios, albeit with short-term flatness in one scenario, we can now see that all three scenarios suggest that house prices will reduce as a multiple of AWE. Like any projections, and as I've already suggested, they should be taken with a huge pinch of salt. But they should also make you think again about the extent to which we have, well, at least a permanent housing crisis. From my analysis, I think that intergenerational equity appears to be holding up reasonably well. My index reasonably well explains the growth, and you can see what happens if factors in that index turn. And I think there are limits to the extent that a generation can be held fully accountable, at least, for the economic environment enjoyed or endured by its successors. Every generation can expect to live through booms and busts, with periods of wage and price inflation above and other periods below long-term trends. So if income and wealth don't look like hot IG issue, intergenerational equity issues after all, what are the real issues? Well, here are two definitions of intergenerational equity. I'll let you read them for yourselves, because there's too many long words in the first one. Surprisingly, perhaps, the Parliamentary Library briefing book for the 44th Parliament, which you would instantly know is the one that produced the 2015 IGR, gave a clear and succinct definition. And it said that the principle of intergenerational equity was that actions benefiting current generations should not compromise future generations. Being an actuary, I think in terms of transfers from one generation to another, but I also like Edith Brown Weiss's definition, holding the earth in trust, being beneficiaries entitled to use it and benefit from it. So in actuarial speak, how can we measure what we transfer to future generations and have received from the past? So this is a quick list to get us started, but I think that this is where the real work needs to be done in relation to intergenerational equity. You'll see that economic well-being makes it onto the list, but it's not dominant. So let's discuss the real issues. What else should be on this list? What is the appropriate order of priority? As actuaries trying to measure intergenerational equity, if we try, is there a different order of priority for attempting that measurement? And does anyone have any gut feel or known measures as to how we are doing in relation to any of these key issues?
Thank you, Richard.
We'll now open up for questions. Please use the mic. No? Okay, well, let me start, Richard. You've defined intergenerational equity as based on two factors, one, disposable house income, and the other, house wealth. And then you've looked at four other things that maybe we should take into account. The one that's missing is tax. And one of the intergenerational issues that's raised is that the younger generations pay and the older generations take. So I think tax, maybe tax is something that should be there. Maybe should stay up there.
Yeah, I will stay up here. Yeah, I'd like to think I got around that by using the household income, disposable income data, which is after tax and welfare transfers. But maybe I didn't completely do that. Also, I would suggest that I was taking a view that the easy way, the normal way to think about intergenerational equity is the financials. And really, I want, despite the fact that 95% of my presentation is about the financials, that's just me being an actuary and working with data. I think the discussion, obviously not necessarily today, but going forward, should be about the other things. But I do feel that there is a big focus on financials, there's a big focus on budget surplus and on how much tax is transferred from some people's pockets and given to others. This morning there was Roger showed the dependency ratio, which is an old-fashioned measure, given that it takes 15 to 64 as working age. 15 is no longer a working age, and 64 is no longer the end of one. So a lot of things actually just move to accommodate things. The reason why more people, why the income factor that I use goes up is because that's in response to it going up. That's how you compete. There will come a time when it's impossible to generate the tax transfers that appear to be being promised from the young to the old. And the response to that will be the old finally being pushed into doing what government can't make them do and spend more time working, because it will not be possible to pay them enough in their retirement. My concern in that regard is the trends that are happening in other countries where the old are getting relatively too much income compared to the national average.
Okay, I have one quick follow-on question from that then. I don't have an issue with a lot of the assumptions you've made just to try and illustrate. You didn't take into account the SGL system, which is actually going to mature somewhere around 2020.
No, I didn't. It's one of many shortcomings in what I've done. A good, you know, university technical piece would be wonderful to see.
Yes, but then we can't read it.
Phil. Phil Stott. Thank you, Rich. That's a fascinating piece of research. If I can even dumb it down further than what you've done, what it basically says is that when you allow for the extra quality and the fact that people are earning more because they have two incomes, that things are pretty much equal, which I guess putting it the other way around suggests that all of the things that we've tried to strive to achieve, you know, in the last generation or so, which is basically, you know, more women in the workforce and higher quality of standard of producing things, is basically all that's gone in is to make it house prices go up by the comparable amount, which is ironic. And it, to me, it confirms the two bits of anecdotal evidence that one sees in terms of the comments that you get from generations. So, for example, the younger generations love to complain, you know, oh, house prices are so hard, we can't afford to buy a house. But then the older generations go and say, oh, when we were first married, we didn't have any furniture and we lived off the cardboard tables and all of that sort of thing. So, I mean, both of those elements are in there. Going on to the other aspects, I mean, the getting beyond the financials, there's two, I get there's a couple of morality issues that I guess come to my mind. The first is that rather than complain about the hardships that we perceive ourselves, whether we're older or younger, we'd be far better off actually being grateful for the good things that we do have, that, you know, that if you're young, then then even though houses might be expensive, at least, you know, you've got good quality stuff lots of stuff that your parents' generations never had. And if you're older, well, be grateful for the fact that you do have a good house price. But the other thing I'd like to throw into the mix, the whole concept of intergenerational equity is predisposed upon the concept of individualism in society, which, of course, is the dominant model. Now, I've spent a fair bit of time in the last couple of years in the Philippines, working with some of the very poorest of people. And one of the most startling things to observe is that even though they have so little, they seem to be happier than we are. And one of the reasons why they're so happy is because they live a communal lifestyle rather than an individualistic one. Families live together, parents with their children, grandparents with them. You know, they might not have much, but they've got loved ones around them. And, you know, maybe it's time for us to reevaluate our priorities. I mean, you know, if the fact that we become more and more wealthy, and individualism obviously is an economic model that actually predisposes us to increase wealth, because that's, you know, I think that's one that does that. But if all it does is create wealth, which then gets plugged into housing that makes us have to work so hard and just to enjoy the same standard of living, then, you know, are we really benefiting from the process?
Well, I think that's why I titled the last two slides "The Real Issues." I think in your Philippines example, the key thing is that everyone's expectation is that they will get the benefits of their more able-bodied, younger family members looking after them and doing what they've done for their parents and so on. So that, I think that's kind of what I'm trying to say, is that however you look at it, whatever your society, there could be lots of different societies, but I think they should, that equity is around the promise that you make and being able to keep it.
Yeah, and absolutely right. And, of course, in our individualistic model, one of the aspects of that is that people of my generation, I'm in my 50s, you know, I'm struggling to reach the right level of money for my retirement, but what I'm bearing in mind is that sometime in the next 10, 15 years or so, my parents are going to die and I'm going to have an inheritance. So all of that intergenerational equity that's built up in the house price, you know, is probably going to fund my retirement.
Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Last question.
Aidan Morrison from the Youngster Initiative. I wanted to... thanks, Richard, for explaining why house prices sort of seem to have got to a point that we can justify paying for based on our increased incomes and the increased quality of the houses. I wanted to ask you whether you had a good explanation for why it is then that such a large proportion of young people aren't able to or aren't willing to pay that higher house price. I'm query whether there could be a divergence in the experienced intergenerational equity, because perhaps the younger cohort doesn't actually get to own or enjoy the larger quality of and value of the housing stock. So we've got potentially an issue where the housing stock improved in quality and it's and our potential to achieve it, but we still have the younger people living in the granny flats and the grannies living in the three or four bedroom houses.
Yeah. So my analysis was very superficial. I don't fully believe it myself, because I think at the moment we have one of those ridiculous markets where people are falling over themselves to bid prices up when they can't even afford the prices they started from. And that's just one of those things that you get from time to time. The opposite happens in the depressions in prices, even if they're only relative. I would say there's two or three factors in housing. One is, it's all very well the cost of what you borrow, but you still need to save up the deposit. So low interest rates skew you for that. The second one is that the median house moves further and further from the city, and you may not be quite as prepared to go there. And the third one is that it becomes harder to devote a particular proportion of your disposable income to paying off a house, particularly if you're a little bit concerned about where the future is heading, your security, job security, the house prices themselves. But also I'm going to get into trouble for saying this, we live in a softer society. There's more to give up. And while I'm not going to, I'm only going to mention smashed avocados to say that I'm not mentioning them.
I think on that point we'll join and thank Richard.
Let me have one more.
One more.
Richard, well done. Steve Somogyi, and I guess I'm representing a few universities, but Monash would be the right one to name today. Richard, there are three factors that governments haven't done, and you would expect a government to intervene because of market failure. So they've created two of those, and the third one they haven't collectively, state and Commonwealth, haven't done. The first one is making the home CGT free,
mm-hmm.
which you didn't take into account in your analysis, no. But it has a significant impact on why more and more people of my age put more and more of their money into their own home rather than into other productive means of creating wealth for the nation. Second one is the introduction, which was a good thing, and rise in contributions to super, which dampened wage growth in the early to mid-90s,
yep.
which would go some way to explaining why your graph looks a little flat
yes.
in the early parts and to the end of the 90s, and then starts taking off again once that's been absorbed into the market. And the third one, so both of those are introductions. You could call them market failure, but really they're interventions.
Yep. Steve,
third one is a market failure.
You're going to have to wind up, please.
I am. And that's lack of supply. And
yeah.
the reason for house prices going up as much as they are is lack of supply. And I think that's a factor that needs to be taken into account.
Yeah, and that's right, Steve. I did intend to say that I was also assuming that the supply was there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. We do have to wind that up, so please thank Richard. Sorry. Not Steve.
Thanks, Steve, as well.